David Rudiak was speaking on an incident at Nellis Air Force Base. By the way, David, welcome.
Oh, thank you.
What happened there in 1994 exactly?
Well, the Nellis Range is about 100 miles northwest of Las Vegas. That's where this incident occurred. And the range is the area where the Top Gun pilots from Nellis Air Force Base in Las Vegas go out and practice. And so they practice bombing and shooting missiles and evading missiles and that sort of thing. The area is covered with TV cameras and radar and communication towers where they monitor what the pilots are doing, and also to keep people out and make sure they don't wander in by accident. So what happened out there is back in November of 1994, one of the cameras got an object that they couldn't identify right on their video camera, and they're zooming in on it and trying to figure out what it is and calling the central controllers and asking if they know what it is. And this object apparently senses that somebody's looking at it. So we get, you have the tracking data on the video. You have good views of this UFO. It starts 10 miles away, but it comes within about 2 miles of the camera. And so you have this very unique piece of footage. It also includes the comments of the operators out there, because they're trying to figure out what it is, and they're pretty excited and pretty bewildered by what this thing looks like. It starts out basically a dot, but as it gets closer, you can see it has a dark bottom and sort of a white dome on top, and then as it gets still closer, all of a sudden these four more white lobes sort of sprout out of the bottom. So it's sort of a four-lobed object, and it seems to change appearance as it progresses along, and it's hard to get a fix on what it exactly it looks like.
Is it a matter of perspective, you think, or is it was actually changing shape, or do you have a conclusion about that?
I'm not exactly sure. They Sightings TV did some analysis on this. They had a government contractor come in and take a look, and he claims it was actually changing. He spoke of it being kind of rubbery and the various parts of it moving around. There's also a very peculiar dark area in this object that you can see it wiggling around at the beginning, and then towards the end it starts glowing almost pure white. So it also seems to change shape. Sometimes it looks round, sometimes it looks elongated. So,
and you came across the video through Sightings or what?
The story with this is that somebody made a copy and they smuggled it out and they sold it to Paramount Studios in early 1995. And then it first appeared on a hard copy program. There used to be a program of that name. And they did a short segment on it, and then Sightings did one on it later December, and they did some analysis.
What is your experience as far as official tape like this, a video? Do you think there's a lot of that out that we don't see, or do you think this was an important occasion? In other words, is this a rare thing or what?
I suspect there's a great deal we haven't seen. The only reason we saw this is because somebody decided to smuggle it out and make some money on it. There are all sorts of stories of gun camera pictures taken from interceptor jets never seeing the light of day, and other sort of film that the government has just disappearing down into a black hole and never being seen again.
One of the things about this Nellis sighting that kind of got me my attention, that's not far from Area 51, the whole complex there. China Lake's not very far away. Of course, we know the government's highly compartmentalized, so maybe these people didn't know anything about saucer craft. Maybe the others did. I don't know. I mean, it's just kind of strange it was right there in that area.
Well, you know, the skeptics sort of acknowledge that the footage looks very genuine, and we can tell that it's filmed out at the range because we can identify one of the mountains in the background there. So the alternative theory is maybe this is a secret government project, maybe from Area 51, which is only about 40 miles away. And we know that whether they're back engineering saucers there or not, they do test secret aircraft like stealth. And the old U-2 was tested out there and developed out there, and the SR-71 Blackbird. So they do develop secret craft, top secret craft. Maybe this was another one. The problem is, according to the range operators who were interviewed, is that if they do fly secret craft out in their vicinity, they always turn the cameras off, and the range operators aren't allowed to see what it looks like or how it performs.
So this was a visitor just showed up. At least it was unplanned.
It just shows up, and they're contacting the controllers and saying, well, what have you got on that? Do you have a name tag or identity for it? And nobody seems to know.
The controller's diatribe, as we were talking, did anybody have a radar fix on this thing?
There's some radar that we get off of this. I had to use other methods to determine how far away it was from the camera. But there are some radar returns. There's another segment. This particular segment I'm talking about is called the S-30 segment. It's some site called S-30. There's another one called S-13 where they have a continuous radar track on some sort of unknown object, but you can't really see what it looks like. It's just too far away. And so you're able to plot a trajectory from this, and they're also calling the control and saying, what have you got on this? We don't know what it is. It's not supposed to be here. And they finally, and they're calling up various stations, finally they get back to them and say, we don't know what it is. And one of the operators also comments that it doesn't have any sort of electronic military signature, a known military electronic signature. They're not.
So that would eliminate that's ours, unless they don't bother to put those on secret aircraft, and I don't know myself.
Well, I think one of the stories the skeptics cite is how when they were developing stealth, they decided to see how effective it was. So they did fly it over a radar site and see if anybody paid any attention to it, and they didn't tell them about it, and I guess they didn't notice it, and they thought that was a pretty good test of the effectiveness of the stealth. So they argue, well, maybe they sent some secret craft out there just to see how people reacted to it.
Well, in your research, what do you think? These government craft, I think it's a kind of a mixture of both out there, but I don't really have much proof. You probably looked at it much more in depth than I have. Is this situation in this area especially a mixture, or is it all government stuff, or none of it's government?
Well, I think these things go back too far for them to be all government stuff. Of course, if they have recovered crash material and have done some back engineering, possibly they've learned a great deal about these craft in the last 50 or 60 years. And, you can't totally rule out the possibility that they have craft that perform in a similar manner, to some of these other craft. But, people were seeing craft like these 100 years ago. There's a Scientific American article, I think, from 1882, where one of our diplomats to some South American country writes about this incident where a family, this bright light lit up their house, and then from his description, it sounds like they were suffered from radiation poisoning. Their skin fell off and their hair fell out. And this is 1882. I mean, this is a real story. This is 50 years before anybody even knew about radiation poisoning. Yeah.
You got an interesting point there. What are you up to these days? What's happening in your life as far as, you got a book about UFOs or something coming out?
Well, actually my chief interest is the Roswell crash, and I've done a lot of research into that. I'm still hitting the archives looking for different news stories that were published at the time. In fact, I'm heading out from here and hopefully hitting some other microfilm archives and seeing what the stories are and as reported in different newspapers. There's also a famous photograph of General Ramey, who was the one who...
I wanted to talk to you about this.
Yes.
What about that photograph? He's holding up that paper. What's it say?
Well, I've done the most study of that photo. It's been blown up. It was taken by a very high-quality press camera back in 1947. And so there's a 4x5 negative, which still exists. And so we're able to blow up that photo, and various people have taken a stab at reading what's on it. And I've put the most time in it, which I think is why I've progressed as far as I have. The key thing are two phrases in the memo. One says talks about the victims of the wreck, and another one talks about something being in the disc that they're shipping on. And so I think that's sort of damning evidence that there really was a crashed disc. General Ramey's calling it a disc. I mean, he uses the word. It's very clear, and that there were victims associated with it. with it of some type. He doesn't call it a spacecraft. He doesn't call it extraterrestrial. He doesn't say the victims are aliens, but something obviously much different than a balloon crash happened out there.
Of course, and they say, well, why would a general hold up something like that? Well, back then, nobody dreamed that technology allowed you to blow something up like that.
Well, actually, there were four photos of him taken and by the same photographer in that photo session, and three of them...
Was this a press photographer?
This is a press photographer. Photographer from from the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. Mm-hmm. His editor sent him out there, and Ramey thought this would be a good opportunity, I think, to spread the weather balloon debunking story. He had an old torn-up weather balloon in his office for the guy to photograph. But in these photos in which Ramey appears, there's four of them that we know about. He's holding this message in his hand, and three of them are turned away from the camera. And on one, it looks like he's sort of flipped his wrist a little bit to steal a glance at it again. And it just by chance, the photographer happened to catch an angle on the message as he was taking a look at it.
Well, I could understand how that would happen. He gets something that's pretty important, a memo, but he's still got the press in there, but he just got a peek. I can understand how.
Well, you know, the skeptics say, well, that never would have happened. He never would have allowed that to happen. But we know of instances where people who should know better have messed up. And one famous instance is during the Johnson administration, his national security advisor was McGeorge Bundy, and the New York Times went in to do a story on McBundy, and they had a photographer there, and in one of the photos, he's holding a binder in his arm, and the photo, which appeared in the New York Times Sunday magazine, clearly shows the title of this document, which turns out to be a very secret, top secret name for, you know, this was during the Vietnam War area. I think it was Top Secret Umbro, which is itself a top secret, mm-hmm. this very name, which had to deal with secret documents concerning the Vietnam War. So this appears in the New York Times, and people can And there was another photo in this very same story where they taking pictures of papers on his desk, and I'm sure some of those were pretty sensitive as well. So this stuff can happen, and it's from people you think would know
better. I imagine that's what you look for in your research when you spend a lot of time in libraries reading press reports and things. You never know what you'll run across.
Well, for example, when people just think there was like only one Roswell story from the Roswell Daily Record, but there were all sorts of Roswell stories. There was Associated Press stories in the Bay, and there were United Press stories, and there were Reuters stories. And so when you look at a lot of newspapers, you see that the press agencies were covering it from different angles, and you get a little bit different information. For example, in some of the stories, they're quoting General Ramey as saying that the object would have been, and presumably he's referring to this weather balloon, would have been 25 feet across if reassembled, and you look at this debris, which you know is only 4 feet across, these mm-hmm. radar targets, and you say, where did he get this 25-foot figure? But then you hear from some of the witnesses who said they saw the disc, and they're also using this 25-foot figure to describe the size. So you wonder if maybe he sort of put that out there as sort of a hedge bet in case the story leaked out that the object that they recovered really was 25 feet across. This would be his explanation. It was just a reassembled, you know, weather balloon.
This is Jerry Pippin. We're at the end of the Ozarks in Eureka Springs with David Rubiak.
So you're going to do a little research here in the Midwest before you leave, huh?
Right. Well, you know, there are other UFO...
I noticed a little prying question there. I'm trying to figure out what you're looking at.
Before I came down to this conference, I went to the... there's a main microfilm archive in Columbia, Missouri. I flew into St. Louis, and I went over to Columbia, which is nearby. And so I was looking for more Roswell stories, but I'm also looking for stories from other periods, which might concern the Midwest. There was a rumored flying saucer crash at Cape Girardeau
right
in 1941. So I looked at the Cape Girardeau paper.
Find anything there?
No, I couldn't find a thing.
Yeah, okay.
There's not a hint of anything in the news. You know, there's some neighboring newspapers, and I looked through this time period when they think it happened, and I couldn't find anything. So something happened that never made the papers.
Of course, that doesn't mean it didn't happen, but it makes you wonder why this 1941 Cape Girardeau story surfaced all of a sudden.
Well, a woman came forward. There was a fellow who was sort of considered the dean of the crash saucer collectors, and his name was Leonard Stringfield, who died, I think, back in 1995. And somebody came to him, a woman named Charlotte Mann, and she says her father had been a Baptist minister, and the military had grabbed him, you know, one evening and taken him out to this crash site, I guess, to administer last rites to these beings. And he came back and told the story, and apparently one of his, somebody in his congregation who was a photographer was taken out there, and he took a picture and gave it to the family. And she says that was in the family for many years, and it was given to her father, and somewhere down the line it got lost, of course.
Yeah.
But it was supposed to show these dead beings, and so that's where the story came from. And that's pretty much all we have to go on.
Well, it's too bad you didn't find something in the paper there.
Oh, yeah, I was hoping the photograph would have been on the front page of the newspaper. Sometimes you get lucky, but usually you're not that lucky.
Well, I remember growing up in Muskogee, Oklahoma, and seeing a headline in 1952 about UFOs over Washington, D.C., and the actual picture of the thing over the Capitol. So it does make papers sometimes.
Well, there's actually a pretty famous photograph from the Roswell period taken by an amateur photographer over in Phoenix of a craft that witnesses say is very similar to what was recovered at Roswell. It's got a scallop shape, and it's not a true circular saucer. It's rounded in the front, but it's got the scallop shape in the back. And he got three fairly good photos of it.
Are you going to be down in Roswell again soon, or?
I've only been there once in my life. I was there, I guess, 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I was...
Now, that picture actually, I guess, surfaced, wasn't... Where'd you find that picture? Did somebody know Paso or somebody come up with that, or was it...
The Ramey photo?
Yeah, right.
Oh, that was actually in many newspapers back then.
Yeah, okay.
The Associated Press bought it. Mm-hmm. Bought rights to it, and so you see it in many newspapers from that era. But the Star Telegram held on to it, and then they passed their photo archives onto the University of Texas.
Okay.
So it's at the University of Texas in Arlington, in their special divisions special collections division. And you can go there and look at it yourself, or you can order prints, you can order enlargements.
Well, I think the whole point was that even though you're an expert on Roswell, you don't have to be there much to find out information.
Well, not really. You know, I'm not so much a field investigator as some of these other people who are amazing. They go out and they interview hundreds of people. I tend to go to the archives, and I tend to collect what other people collect and try to put all the pieces together, you know. So I think of myself more of an analyst rather than a field investigator.
You have CIA experience?
Not that I know of.
I have enjoyed it. All right.